still the 29th of May. We're still with Walter Jagut. We're starting the tape 16, side 32. And we were just talking about the cruise that Walter Jagut was on for Seder, and he was describing his room. Some of it didn't come on, the two rooms.
This was this luxury ship. Almost all the cabins also had a balcony. On our deck, they did not, but everybody else did, and there were lots of public facilities, of course, you know, a swimming pool, a large-sized swimming pool, and a library, rather good library, a computer, which I used, which only worked so-so, shows every night, movies you could check out, videos if you wanted them. So anything you really wanted, two restaurants, plus an additional special meal every night if you wanted to sign up for that. And if you found if you were interested in something and it was not on the menu, you could ask for that too. Irene once sat down with somebody who ordered a double portion of caviar to start the supper. And so Irene said, well, I think I'll have the same. Of course, there was wine with every meal, at least two kinds of wine with every meal. This was really super deluxe in every way. But the people were very nice, and we thought that they would be not old, because you can't fly to Bangkok if you are in your 80s. You're unlikely to. But they were, the age range was from the mid-30s, up through the late 60s, early 70s, and it was entirely international. There were people from everywhere. As it turned out, we had no idea how many Jews there would be, and I was anonymous till the Friday evening before the Seder, so nobody made a fuss about me as being a rabbi or the like, or bothered me with counseling questions or the like. It turned out that there were 48 people who came to the Seder, and three or four who were Jewish who did not come to the Seder. And these people came from England, South Africa, North America, that's the United States, as well as Canada, France, there was an Israeli, and I think somebody from Central America, I've forgotten where. And there were also an Australian, a Jew. So this was really international. The Seder itself was okay. They had done their best to get the chef ready, and he tried very hard to produce home-cooked gefilte fish, which was certainly unique. They unfortunately had misinformed me about the supply of haggadahs. So I discovered about a half hour before the Seder that I'd been told that they were ample, so I didn't have to worry about that, but there were actually only 10. So it was a little difficult to conduct a Seder for which most people didn't have text in front of them. So this had to be done more or less as best one could. But we sang and we went through as much as one could possibly go through. The bread of affliction, the matzah, was really bread of affliction because they had unloaded that some time before, and it was reasonably stale.
I didn't know matzah could be stale.
Oh, yes.
Stale.
It sure can.
Mm-hmm.
But it was okay, and the Friday evening service and the Shabbat morning service were also fine, and although nobody asked for that, I insisted that we have a service on each festival morning. There was as it turned out, there was a tour each time, because we went ashore on this 13-day cruise every day except 3 days. So the services had to be at 6:30 in the morning. But
how many attended?
Well, that was just a handful of people who came to that. But it was interesting to meet these individuals and to talk to them, and also quite a surprise to see that a quarter of the people were Jewish.
Was it advertised as a sailor tour?
No, it was not.
So the ship is so elegant that they provide a rabbi in case, or what?
Yes. For the holidays, for Jewish holidays. On the previous cruise, which had been over Easter, they had a priest on board. The personnel, by the way, was also highly international. I think there were 25 different nationalities represented among the waiters and the other personnel.
Did any non-Jews come to the Seder, do you know?
Two of them did, yes, and some other people asked about it, and so they discovered. We talked a little bit about Pesach and the Seder, what it means. It was a strange mixture, as conducting a Seder for a group that you don't know at all is a little difficult, because you're really running in the dark.
So did you do all of it in Hebrew or partial? Did you have Orthodox Jews that you were aware of?
There would be no Orthodox Jew
coming on a cruise,
especially as the cruise ship departed on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
So that would be unlikely. No, they were most of them were very interested in having this in English, as was made very clear to me, because right close to the beginning of the Seder, there's a Kiddush, which I, of course, sang in Hebrew. And immediately somebody piped up and said, "Aren't you going to do this in English?"
And what was the consensus at that moment? I mean, did you...
Well, I didn't... I don't operate on consensus.
No, I know you don't, but did you get the feeling that...
Oh, I was going to conduct a good bit of it in English and some of it in Hebrew. And they were going to have to live with whatever they got. There wasn't much choice in that.
They might not go on the cruise again, but they're going to get you.
No, it was very nice. And then we made it a policy during this whole cruise to not to sit with one group of people, but to sit with different people for every meal. So we really met lots and lots of people. Mainly non-Jews, talked about what they did, what they'd seen. And these people are very widely traveled. We were among the least traveled on board. And Vietnam, we saw Saigon, by the way, both in Yangon and in Saigon, there were congregations once. But there is no active congregation in either of those places now. The cities are very, very nice, what is left of the French influence, the way in which they've been laid out. If Vietnam is communist, then my understanding of communism is totally wrong, because it is 100% free enterprise. Not only are you hustled all the time, even when you're far from the cruise ship, it's unclear whether you are just a walking tourist or one of these people from the boat. And you can buy anything on the street. You want to buy a refrigerator, a television set, clothes. Now, I was in Warsaw under communism, and if you looked at a store and saw what they had in the window and then went in, they may have had four or five other dresses that were hanging in the back. The others were all in the window. Here, you'd find a store with 150, 200, 300, a little room, dresses of all kinds. everything is available, but on the other hand, people are also very, very poor. You see people building roads by pounding the stones, making them smaller with a hammer, and working piecework all day. You know, we took a trip to Hanoi by bus, and came back, left about 6 in the morning, and came back about 7 in the evening. The people were still, the same people were still out there pounding stones 12 hours later. Vietnam has a checkered history, not much of historical interest in many sections. You know, I was in Saigon before, in 56, visiting the American personnel and trying to see if they needed anything for Pesach or any other holiday. And I thought I would stay a little longer, look around, and I only stayed a day and a half because there wasn't anything to see. The same is still true. And there are, in central Vietnam, in the imperial capital, there's more to see, Hue, and a few other places. But otherwise, the neighboring countries like Cambodia, far more interesting from a historical perspective.
Did you go to Cambodia?
I've been to Cambodia. I would not go now because there are still too many unexploded landmines.
When were you in Cambodia?
In 57. Yes. Oh, yes.
Same.
It's marvelous. And some of the other ruins are also wonderful.
Yeah.
And of course, I was there at the, that was kind of funny too, because all the tour, this was the only time in those years I took a tour, was the only way to get there. And I was probably 40 years younger than anybody else. And when we stopped for a while, people got out and climbed to the top of the monument. In short order, they stopped doing that. But I insisted on doing that because I'd paid for the tour. So they were not very happy with me. Every time there was another monument, I got out. They had to wait 10 minutes till I
climbed up there.
Climbed up and back down and looked at them. In Vietnam, you get a real feeling for the difficulty of the terrain, which is enormously difficult. And to have to fight through that must have been sheer hell. And also the beauty of the terrain. It is physically a beautiful country. And there are places up north. We went to a bay called Halong Bay, where there are perhaps 800 or 900 small islands, little, really rocks that come out of the sea. It's one of the most dramatic seascapes I've ever seen anywhere.
What's the name of the bay for?
Halong. The people are very careful about dealing with the war. They, you know, because this is a cruise, they had a guide. You could have gone on your own, but it would have been very difficult. And we also didn't know, you know, what kind of facilities were available. So we chose to go on the trips. When the guides talked about the Vietnamese War, they talked about the hard times.
They've been coached, I'm sure.
Well, I don't think they needed coaching. They wanted a big tip. I've never seen as much military equipment, at least since I wasn't military. Captured American equipment in museums.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how is it presented? I mean, what is it?
Well, I can't tell you that because I can't read Vietnamese.
Okay, and the guide.
Well, you know, in those places we don't wander around with a guide. In fact, in those places we just wander very quickly and then go on our own because I'm really not interested in seeing grenade launchers and tanks and so on.
I'm just curious what the comments were, how, and you know.
Well, I'm sure that was put very gentle. There's a museum to Ho Chi Minh in every city. We visited two of them on our own. And
what was your impression?
Well, he obviously was a good leader and a very able leader.
And the museums, what was in the museum?
Whatever there is of his life, you know, that tells you his life story in various ways, photographs, objects, and so on. And his mausoleum, sort of a smaller version of Lenin's mausoleum, which happened to be closed by the time we got there. We were there a little too late. But the Vietnamese are not a gentle people in comparison to the Burmese. Much more aggressive with each other. And
what is the religion?
Ostensibly they are Buddhist, and there's also a fair percentage of Catholics, maybe 20%. In the Catholic churches we saw very large crowds. We went to a church on a Sunday and we couldn't get in. We stood outside. We partly went to escape a very persistent set of bicycle rickshaw drivers who followed us for 2 hours trying to get our business. But we wanted to walk, because you see a city by walking, not by having somebody pedal you around. The Buddhist shrines there were few of them, and totally empty. And so when we asked about that, they all said they do it at home, they pray at home. Well, I said to myself, that's probably what one would say about a large number of Jews.
Don't look at me.
I
saw that.
Do you think the fact that the Burmese were under British rule, whereas the Vietnamese were under French rule, makes a difference in their personalities, aggressiveness?
I don't think that. I think there's some other things where it probably makes a difference.
There are
they are very different people.
Yeah.
And one also has to remember that in both countries, there are lots and lots of minority groups. And if you read the history of Burma, you see that it's a continual, it's like a kaleidoscope. Know, this group gets together and rules for 150 years, and then the whole thing is shaken up again. There's another coalition, and they rule from a different capital for another 150 or 200 years. It's really only under the British, and then subsequently under the military regime, that the country has really been
a country
united. Yes. And we saw in one, as it turned out, in a combination zoo and botanical garden, a large group of hill people who were taken to Yangon to see the city. And then we saw them again up in the mountains beyond Mandalay, where we visited. One could have done a lot more in Burma, we just didn't have the time to do that. And in Vietnam you also have minority groups off in the hills.
Do you have a lot of tourists? A few tourists in Burma.
In Vietnam, there are more tourists, yes, and there are also more Americans. And again, well, in this case, the impression I got was that, interestingly enough, the hotel facilities are not as good as in Burma, and they're just beginning to move in that direction.
From the occupancy of the church, which is 20% of the people of Vietnam, opposed to 80% being Buddhists, and they're being empty, that's a very interesting...
There, in fact, there are very few shrines.
Yeah.
For example, if you walk down the street in Thailand, you'd find shrines in very unexpected places. modern office building, shopping center, and people are, and they're not just standing there. Obviously something's happening because there are flowers and there are floral necklaces around the statues of Buddha. So people are going there and worshiping.
Well, I'm aware
that... Not in Vietnam. That when we visited the historical monuments, not in Pagan, where there are thousands of them and there are only, you know, a handful of people who live nearby. But anywhere else, the historical sites are also places of worship, not in Vietnam. Didn't even have to take your, I mean, if you wanted to, you needn't have taken your shoes off because nobody would have stopped you or said anything.
Now,
is that because of communism?
I don't know. I really don't know. Well, maybe it never was all that strong there. I don't know enough about.
Well, DM was a strong force in the Catholic. That's connection
yes.
with Kennedy. So I remember that very vividly. Now the Muslims pray four to five or six times a day. Do the Buddhists do that too? So I mean that gives you some. Most people go to church or synagogue once a day. And I know the Muslims, they pray four or five. They don't have to go to their temple, I don't think, or to their mosque.
They pray wherever they are.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, the Buddhists, do they?
They will go, how often, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
But we did talk to a couple of people who indicated that they go, in this particular case, almost every day. You know, I can't really say. Don't know enough about it.
Sounds like you had a very interesting trip. You said you wouldn't necessarily want to repeat the Seder situation. What?
Well, it's not even so much the Seder. It's. I don't think you cannot really see a country from a cruise ship because you're returning to America every night. It's too and it's also too luxurious.
Did you have to get dressed every night?
Had to, three times, it was formal. But I tell you, that was a kind of a homecoming because, you know, I wear a tuxedo as infrequently as possible. You know, somebody invites me to a formal wedding here, I will show up in a suit, even if I'm the only one in a suit. Because I just don't like tuxedos. But in this case, tuxedos were demanded, so I took a tuxedo along. That's a tuxedo which had been made in the Philippines 45 years ago. Still fits.
That's a compliment to your physique. Quite a compliment. It must have made you feel good. Did Rini have to, I remember Rini talked about buying gowns. She had to have formal gowns?
No, she wore cocktail dress or such. But every night was specified, you know, informal, which meant a jacket and a tie, or very informal, that meant you had come in from a tour late. Whenever you came in from a tour, by the way, even if it was just for a few hours, you were greeted as you came up the gangplank with champagne and hors d'oeuvres.
Did you have trouble coming back down to earth, or were you happy to land?
Oh, it was enough. It was enough. And we had one rough day at the end, which we had 20-foot waves, so really high seas.
Did you sick?
I got sick. We both got sick when we started packing, because then you know, you're not only have to deal with the motion of the ship, but you're constantly bending and whatnot.
Were there physicians there to help you out for any?
Well, this doesn't need a physician.
No, did you get a patch or something like that?
We could have gotten a patch,
right.
But we didn't. And there was a physician, of course, on board.
What nationality?
Probably Italian. All those people at the captain and all those folks were Italian.
Was it an Italian line then?
The ship is owned, it's headquartered in Palermo. And it sails around the world. You know, they, from Hong Kong they were going back to Bangkok, then to Singapore, then to Bombay, I believe, then along the Persian Gulf, and then to Mediterranean. You know, they go all sorts of places.
Now, what I wanted to do, but it's too late now, I wanted to ask you about your trip to Munich, which is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, our interview has gone almost full circle, because when you started out and you left the seminary and you went to the Far East, you've got a, it's amazing,
Well, I should say that one of the nice things of the next few days will be ordaining this young man. His name is Walter Homolka.
Is he the one
Homolka?
That
had,
I think so.
Is he head of the publishing house?
He's not head of the publishing house, no. He is the chief of staff to the president. So he will continue that, and he will be part-time as a rabbi. He studied in London a decade ago. And so he's going to be ordained here, and the people involved will be one person who taught him in London, one of his professors, and one person from Israel, and myself.
Why is he being ordained in the United States instead of in Germany?
Well, he's being ordained here because, I guess it's Pittsburgh, because I'm here. And my connection with Munich,
head rabbi,
and the other people were accessible here rather than in Germany.
Isn't that interesting? Will there be any kind of a ceremony then in Munich as well?
He'll be inducted as their rabbi.
Will you be there?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Oh,
in fact, I should have brought in the invitation. They printed up a very nice, elaborate invitation.
Excuse me, will you bring it for the next meeting that we have?
Well, if I remember, I'll put it on your list.
There you
Wait,
go.
Within the next,
here.
When it's done.
Yes, at the end of June, and what we'll also have at the end of June is a major conference in the someplace on the outskirts of Munich, of Frankfurt, of Reformed Jews. That'll be a couple of hundred people.
How long will you be in Munich this time?
Well, the total German trip is about 2.5 weeks.
And then you go to teach in Berlin, don't you?
That's next spring.
Oh, in the spring. Okay, I thought it was this year. All right. So you really, how are you enjoying all this? Is this really...
Well, the traveling this summer is going to be a bit much.
But I mean, how are you? You have another career, another life. And
oh yes.
And how are you?
I'm enjoying it. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't do it. I could. All of these things are things that I could drop, forget about.
Well, I am allowed to comment because I'm the interviewer and I'm taking privileges today. From the looks of you, and how well you look, and happy you seem, it's really done you well so far. I approve.
I can recommend retirement. No, this these symposia for the Law Institute, because this year four of them are scheduled, which is more than before, and they should be interesting. Should work out very well.
What seems so wonderful, and you know, listening to the tapes, I spent a lot of time listening to your tapes, that I did the note-taking one, is that you really. If at some point traveling becomes too much of a hassle for you, you have two different careers here at one time, because locally you have so much that you have with the museums and with the small town. So it just sounds ideal.
Oh, yeah. Well, this month has been really busy and somewhat hectic, primarily because of the garden. Irene put a tremendous amount of effort into the biblical garden. Then last week we had the danger of a frost, and she had positioned all the plants and put them in, and I spent 4 hours taking them all out again. So that, because in one night you could have ruined everything. And then we spent a couple of days this week putting things back again. And at the same time, I was trying to do the garden at home, too, so that that wouldn't be totally neglected.
Which is an exquisite garden. Walter, covering the garden, the plants with newspaper would not have helped.
Well, you can't cover things that are
that high,
6 feet high. So the only way to do it is to...
You can take palms down.
The palms, that's the only... The bananas, yes. The palms were too big. There we just had to take a chance. But they can take, not a frost, but they, it wouldn't kill them. But all the others had to come in, and all the, you know, the angel trumpets.
And lots of them.
There wasn't a frost, was there?
I think there was a slight frost because
in the city,
a couple of things were touched. You could see that they were, you know, the leaves were, and some things would just go, you know, cinnamon at the end of the banana.
Might as well comment on for the future that this, the month of May in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.